This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. On the way, we'll have a feature report on hydraulic fracturing and the possibility that waste produced by fracking could be dumped in deep well injection sites right here in eastern North Carolina. But first, North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory unveiled his spending plan last month to take effect July 1st through mid-2015. This week, we focus on the Medicaid overhaul and cuts in unemployment benefits. L.C. Morris has more.
One of the first measures signed into law by incoming Republican Governor Pat McCrory was a reduction in benefits for the unemployed.
They will either see their federal benefits immediately cut off as of July 1st, and they will also be subject to these changed terms of the state's unemployment insurance system.
Alexandra Saroida, director at the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center.
In addition to reducing the number of weeks that an unemployed worker can receive, there also will be changes to the amounts of benefits, changes to the maximum dollars that a worker can receive, and a number of other provisions that will affect the kinds of work that workers need to take in order to remain eligible.
The state borrowed $2.5 billion from the federal government to pay unemployment benefits, giving the unemployed an extension. Reducing the benefits by one-third means rejecting $700 million in federal dollars.
Because our unemployment insurance system did not have adequate funds built up before the Great Recession, we had to borrow from the federal government. The reason for our lack of funds was we cut taxes on employers in the 90s, and we also saw significant job loss during the Great Recession. So in combination, that made our unemployment insurance trust fund at unsafe levels as the recession started. And as a result, employers under this proposal will see a slight increase in their federal tax contributions and a very minimal increase in their state tax contributions.
As of July 1st, weekly benefits will max out at $350, a drastic drop from $535. And the number of weeks for the unemployed to collect will move to 12 to 20 weeks from the now maximum of 26 weeks.
The maximum number of weeks will be dependent on the statewide unemployment rate. And that's something I think that's really particularly important for counties out east, where the unemployment rate has traditionally been much higher than the state average, significantly higher in some cases where, for example, in Edgecombe County, you have unemployment rates of 15% when the state unemployment rate is hovering around 9%.
No matter what county you are in or how high jobless rates are in your community, the cap on the length of time is across the board, says Saroida. House Bill 4, Unemployment Insurance Solvency and Program Changes. An act to address the unemployment insurance debt and to focus North Carolina's unemployment insurance program on putting claimants back to work.
An employer does pay into the unemployment insurance system. They pay based on how often in the past they've laid off workers. And what this bill does, because it so drastically reduces benefits, and because the state's unemployment insurance system has had to borrow in order to pay benefits, employers have seen their taxes go up in the past year, and it will continue to go up until the loan's paid off. That's just the nature of how the federal system lends money to the state.
Rejecting federal funds for the extension of unemployment benefits is in a list of many other cuts. McCrory has also rejected the expansion of Medicaid, which would have been made possible by the Affordable Care Act. McCrory says the Medicaid system in the state is broken. A performance audit of the Department of Health and Human Services, which operates the Medicaid program, cited mismanagement and structural flaws. Carol Steckel is the newly appointed Medicaid director of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services.
Really would prefer not going through the details of the audit just because, one, it's painful, but two, we're correcting all of the issues pointed out in the audit, and a lot of it had to do with the way we do projections and forecasting. Some of it had to do with a disagreement about ways that we were caring for rebate money and managing the program itself. But we are correcting all of those, and everything will be fully in place by June 30th. And I have promised both the secretary, the governor, and the auditor that we will not have an audit like that ever again under my watch.
According to the audit, the structural flaws translate to an additional $180 million in Medicaid administration than other states that are very much alike in size. As for budget forecasting, Medicaid has spent $1.4 billion over its budget from 2009 to 2012. It was also found that the Division of Medical Assistance withheld $131 million in drug rebate refunds and $13 million in inflationary adjustments to nursing homes. Steckles says the Medicaid reform can and will be done in stages, and that suggestions at their request for public information has not gone unnoticed.
We are looking at the Medicaid reform in a series of stages. There'll be some immediate things that we'll be able to do over the next 3 months, and we specifically asked for them in the RFI that if you knew of ways that we could improve the program and save money in the short term, please submit those. So those will take on very quickly and move them through the system rapidly. The second stage is how do we improve the Medicaid program over a long term to make it both sustainable and predictable in a much more effective manner.
Currently, there are about 1.6 million people in the state on Medicaid. Sherry Hay, who is the Director of Community Health Initiatives at UNC Family Medicine, says of that 1.6 million, about 70% are families and children.
Not all 1.6 of those are anticipated to be covered if we had expanded Medicaid. Only, and the estimates vary, only between 600,000 and 800,000 of those would have been covered. Because the Accountable Care Act does not provide any coverage for undocumented individuals in any state. So there would be some that would not have been eligible anyway, but there was hundreds of thousands that could have potentially gained coverage through Medicaid had we chosen to expand that will not have that option to enroll in Medicaid today.
Governor McCrory announced this week that North Carolina's Medicaid program will soon be privatized. The state would contract out comprehensive care entities. Managed care providers who compete as they deliver medical, mental, and dental services throughout the state would get paid on a monthly per patient basis. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Downey's Journal. Hydraulic fracturing seems to be the new solution for North Carolina's harvested energy. More than 9,000 acres of land in Chatham, Moore, and Lee counties has been purchased by out-of-state companies for drilling. But some worry about the possibility of a byproduct of fracking being stored in eastern North Carolina. Senate Bill 820, ratified last year by Governor McCrory, legalizes hydraulic fracturing in North Carolina. In February, with the introduction of Senate Bill 76, there's a real possibility there will be permits issued so that energy companies can begin drilling hydraulic fracturing wells. Despite the guidelines in place for fracking in other states, including North Dakota, Pennsylvania, and Texas, North Carolina created the Mining and Energy Commission that began meeting last year to come up with specific guidelines for fracking in this state. If Senate Bill 76 passes, the commission has a year and a half left to finish the guidelines. Although those rules won't be significantly different, according to the members of the rulemaking commission, the fracking industry is still rife with debate. Chief among the debates is the disposal of water left over from hydraulic fracturing. Stephen O'Connell has more.
The North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission is made up of committees that each deliberate on different aspects of hydraulic fracturing. Executive Director of the Research Triangle Energy Consortium, Dr. Vikram Rao, is on the Wastewater Management Commission.
We are doing it later than others, and I like to use the principle of making a virtue of being late. If you're going to be late, make a virtue of it by being righter than the others. learning from other people's mistakes.
Although commission members have not yet spoken on the possibility of deep injection wells, recent media coverage indicates it may be disposed of in locations around eastern North Carolina. In Pennsylvania, an average frack requires more than 4 million gallons of water. An enormous amount of that water comes back up the well. The liquid contains the sand and chemical mixture used for the injection and water that flows underground with the natural gas. The water is therefore deemed hazardous. There are a few common methods of handling wastewater, including disposing of it in deep wells, treating the water and reusing it, or storing it in evaporation ponds. The most common method is using deep injection wells, holes deeper than the fracking wells where water is stored for an indefinite time. There are over 150,000 Class II deep injection wells for leftover fracking fluid in the United States. A few weeks ago, environmental engineer and hydrogeologist Republican Representative Rick Catlin of Wilmington said that if the ban on Class II deep injection wells is lifted, then the water would most likely be disposed of in eastern North Carolina. The statement bothered a lot of people. Deep injection wells were legal at one point in North Carolina, but in the early 70s, the investigation of a company outside Wilmington called Hercules proved that a Class II well had contaminated the drinking water aquifers around it. Class II underground injection wells were then banned. Senate Bill 76 allows underground injection of the briny water left over from a frack. Last week, I went to a meeting in Greenville where Riverkeeper of the Hall River Assembly, Elaine Chioso, made a presentation that dealt mostly with the dangers of fracking.
And most people, when they hear that, just say, that doesn't sound like a very good idea. Just intuitively, I think most of us think we just probably shouldn't be fooling around with Mother Nature that way. We don't know what's going to happen to that water down there, and it is contaminated. So, is it going to slowly move up through those fissures and fractures and join with, the groundwater that we use for well water? Probably.
Members of the commission, including Rao, do not believe that residents of eastern North Carolina should be concerned with deep injection wells. Dr. Charles Holbrook, who is on the commission, says the geology of the coastal plains is not suitable.
You can only dispose of water in sedimentary rock formations that have porosity and permeability, and it needs to be done quite deeply with lots of good sealing beds above. And so that's just, the geology just doesn't exist in eastern North Carolina for that type of operation.
The Black Creek Aquifer extends as far east as Carteret County, as far south as Brunswick, and west all the way to Hoke and Wayne counties. Black Creek, the Castlehaine Aquifer, and the other smaller aquifers around it can yield as high as 400 gallons of water per minute, which means they have good permeability and porosity. Professor of Environmental Sciences at Duke University, Dr. Rob Jackson, researches wastewater and groundwater contamination in natural gas producing states like Pennsylvania.
This is a pretty porous geology, in many cases a fairly sandy geology in coastal North Carolina. So fluids like water and gas move around a lot in those cases. That's good news if you're trying to pump high volumes of wastewater underground because it allows that water to spread out underground. But it can be bad news if it means that water migrates. So I just think we need to be very careful before we start this again.
Professor Jackson believes that we need to study the deeper underlying geology to understand whether eastern North Carolina would be an appropriate place for deep injection wells. But he also points out something far more important.
Do residents there want the waste to come to their area? I mean, there will be jobs that come with this. I don't know how many jobs. There will be some money, but there'll be a lot of truck traffic. There'll be a lot of wastewater that's brought, much of it with toxic chemicals in it. Do residents want that? And just as importantly, how will safeguards be put in place to keep problems from happening like they happened in the 1960s and 1970s?
Although Dr. Holbrook and Dr. Jackson disagree on some points, they agree that the best method of managing the wastewater is to treat it and reuse it. Dr. Rao, who also agrees with the reuse method, says that in this state, unlike others, treating the water and reusing it will be more cost-effective. it is still a mystery how energy companies will choose to dispose of their wastewater. We also don't know whether the coastal plain is a viable option for deep injection wells. Here's what we do know. Underground injection wells have been tried in our region before and resulted in a contamination. The question that remains is whether the contamination was the fault, quite literally, of the rock below or the fault of the company that was injecting the water. I talked with some of the people that went to the Greenville meeting last week, and for most of them, the presentation fueled their disagreement over fracking. Jake Gelligode of Raleigh works with an organization called Democracy North Carolina.
So none of the financial boon for this region, but dumping the waste in this region, and that's, this area already has enough crap going on that, I don't know, it's just disturbing, I guess is how I'd sum it up.
Riverkeeper for the Pamlico Tar River Foundation, Heather Deck.
With the change in this bill and the potential for that wastewater to be coming to coastal Carolina, along with the fact that once you open that door, we could have injection of many other different types of wastewater, knowing that coastal Carolina gets its groundwater and our drinking water comes from the ground, so that's definitely a big concern that I think we all need to be aware of.
Geology professor at East Carolina University, Alex Manda, says he went to the meeting to understand people's perceptions of hydraulic fracturing.
It might seem that there is a lot of sentiment that is based on conjecture, whereas we might not really know what's going on, but it just sounds good to say it, and so we say it, and then people run with that. So I think a lot of misconceptions on that end.
While I found District Representative Rick Catlin's comments to be overstated, it opened the ears of Eastern North Carolina residents to an issue that demands attention. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, offering expert advice to assist in providing the proper foods and shelter for backyard birds during this nesting season. Wild Birds Unlimited, 2029 South Glen Burnie Road, New Bern, and online at wbu.com/newbern. It's a sign of spring and warm weather. Birds returning to eastern North Carolina after spending the winter down south. But for one species, making the journey back home has become perilous. The dovekie, a small Arctic bird resembling a penguin, only stands an average 8 inches tall, but it makes a 1,000-mile journey every spring. Recently, more than a dozen dovekies have been found washed up on the North Carolina coast, starving and injured. The Possumwood Acres Wildlife Sanctuary in Hubert has been on the front lines in trying to rehabilitate the emaciated birds. Over the past decade, Executive Director Tony O'Neill remembers only one dovekie coming in. This year, they've treated more than 15.
They're pelagic birds, meaning they're birds that are going to be found way out at sea. They're way out on the other side of the Gulf Stream. You're never going to really see them on the shore, and we certainly should not be seeing them coming in anywhere on the coast of North Carolina right now.
When a group of stranded, starving birds appear, it's known as a wreck. According to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the largest record wreck in North America occurred in the winter of 1932 when dovekies rained down on the streets of New York City, and large numbers washed up along the entire eastern seaboard from Nova Scotia to Florida. While nothing of this magnitude has happened since, O'Neill says the sanctuary is seeing an unusual number of dovekies up and down the North Carolina coast.
There have also been some reports of, right off the surf line, people were watching a small little raft of them, of about maybe 15 to 20, all just kind of swimming around. Very, very unusual, being in a place where they shouldn't be.
And it's not just North Carolina. Wildlife shelters in Virginia have treated a half dozen dovekies in the past month. No one really knows why the birds are turning up here, but O'Neill suggests recent storms may have blown them off course. It's also possible the dovekies were in search of food.
They come in, we give them fluid therapy. We tube them with the IV fluid, just like you do in the hospital, with a lactated ringer solution, what they call an electrolyte solution, and we just give them some of that to kind of perk their system back up. And then when they seem to be a little stronger, then we'll offer them small slivers of fish.
Another issue scientists and wildlife advocates are scratching their heads over is why the dovekies are suddenly dying after receiving treatment. Of the 15 birds that O'Neill has received, none have survived.
When they come in, they're up on their little feet and they're kind of hopping all around and they're making little squawky noises and they're bright-eyed and perky looking and they're snapping at you and you're like, oh, well, you should be fine in a couple of days. And then all of a sudden, they fall over and die. Boom, just like that.
Dovekies are highly stressed birds, and the fact that they are out of their natural habitat can overwhelm them and cause them to die suddenly.
I was checking to see with other rehabilitators to see, was I doing something wrong? Is there something I could do better? Is there a different treatment I should try? Checked all the way from Wilmington down to Oak Island and then all the way up into Ocracoke. Everybody is having the same problems. None of them are making it.
O'Neill says the dovekies brought to the sanctuary have black excrement, which is unusual. Scientists are investigating the possibility that the birds ingested something toxic, such as algae from red tide. Dr. Craig Harms is the associate professor with the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University, based at the Center for Marine Sciences and Technology in Morehead City. Dr. Harms says four dovekies were sent to them for testing.
Main thing was there's no outstanding gross lesions, but every one of them was really thin, which is not too unusual for some of the seabirds that we see down here out of range.
After performing the autopsy, tissue samples were sent to the Southeast Cooperative Wildlife Research Group at the University of Georgia for further analysis. They also submitted samples to the Toxicology and Pathology Lab, looking specifically for naturally occurring toxins.
That's not something that's going to be run or available for a while. Yeah, red tide, the brevetoxin, or domoic acid, which is caused by another marine organism, both do occur occasionally off of our coast. Fortunately, not quite as often as they do further south, but it's something that we need to look out for.
If you happen upon a dovekie that's injured or in need of care, Possumwood Acres Tony O'Neill says it's important that the bird be treated right away.
We tell them to go get a little small towel and just pick them up with the towel and then put them with the towel into a box so that they can sit on the towel and then just close the box so it'll look kind of like dark and quiet for them. That will help reduce stress. And then just to get on the phone and call us, and then we'll give them directions and they can go ahead and bring it here.
The phone number is 910-326-6432. For information on wildlife rehabilitation at the nonprofit Possumwood Acres in Hubert, visit our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, I've had the opportunity to interact with, capture, and hive another bee swarm. I have to tell you, working with swarms is my absolute favorite part of beekeeping. The queen, recognizing that the hive is getting very, very crowded in the spring, releases pheromones that start the bees thinking about splitting off and starting a new hive. A new queen cell is built, an egg is laid, and a new queen is raised. And right before that queen hatches, the old queen leaves the hive with about half of the bees at her side. Now this is one of the most wonderful parts of a bee swarm. The queen flies into the air, followed by thousands and thousands and thousands of bees. They fill the airspace above the hive. It's a swirling mass of humming bees, and it's beautiful. You can actually watch the cloud of bees as they shift to the left, then to the right, backwards and forwards, all of them sticking near the queen as she searches for a branch or somewhere else to land. As soon as the queen has found a place to land, the bees quickly descend from the air and gather around her in a large clump. This is what people see when they think about swarms of bees. While the queen is there, protected by most of the bees, scouts go out looking for a new hive location and come back to tell the rest of the bees about it. That's where the beekeeper comes in. If the swarm is within reach, you bring a box and some sugar water in a spray jug, squirt the bees with a little sugar water, and shake them into the box. If you've gotten the queen, any bees that are loose will fly into the box as well. Put on the lid and immediately take them to a hive that's prepared and ready. Then it's as simple as dumping the bees in the hive. When I hived this swarm, it was huge, and I think the queen went in, but a lot of bees went up in the air. They flew back and forth just like a regular swarm would. And I'm not sure if the queen was with them and we were lucky enough that she flew down into the hive. I think that's unlikely. Or if the queen was already in the hive, had been properly shaken in, and the other bees were simply searching for her scent. In any event, after a few minutes, this mass of bees, probably 5 or 6 pounds of bees, if you can picture that, descended from the air and gathered on the front of the hive. Then, when they realized the queen was in fact inside, they marched in regular lines. As a swarm, they were prepared to start a new home. So I know they immediately began cleaning up the comb that was inside and maybe even laying down some new comb. Hives are great at getting quickly established, and I hope I might even get some honey from them this year. Watch for bee swarms yourself this spring, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.